Let's begin our study today with prayer. Father God, we thank you for giving us your word and the testimony of your apostles. Help us to understand more about you from your word and their testimony. We thank you for having mercy upon us through your son Yeshua, in whose name we pray. Amen.
Acts chapter 21, 27. Now when the 7 days were almost ended, the Jews from Asia, seeing him in the temple, stirred up the whole crowd and laid hands on him, crying out, "Men of Israel, help! This is the man who teaches all men everywhere, and furthermore he has also brought..." "This is the man who teaches all men everywhere against the people, the law, and this place, and furthermore he also brought Greeks into the temple and has defiled this holy place." For they had previously seen Trophimus the Ephesian with him in the city, whom they supposed that Paul had brought into the temple. And all the city was disturbed, and the people ran together, seized Paul, and dragged him out of the temple, and immediately the doors were shut. Now as they were seeking to kill him, news came to the commander of the garrison that all Jerusalem was in an uproar. He immediately took soldiers and centurions and ran down to them. And when they saw the commander and the soldiers, they stopped beating Paul. Then the commander came near and took him and commanded him to be bound with two chains. And he asked who he was and what he had done. And some among the multitude cried one thing and some another. So when he could not ascertain the truth because of the tumult, he commanded him to be taken into the barracks. When he reached the stairs, he had to be carried by the soldiers because of the violence of the mob, for the multitude of the people followed after, crying out, "Away with him!" Then as Paul was about to be led into the barracks, he said to the commander, "May I speak to you?" He replied, "Can you speak Greek? Are you not the Egyptian who some time ago stirred up a rebellion and led the 4,000 assassins out into the wilderness?" But Paul said, "I am a Jew from Tarshish in Cilicia, a citizen of no mean city, and I implore you, permit me to speak to the people." So when he had given him permission, Paul stood on the stairs and motioned with his hands to the people. And when there was a great silence, he spoke to them in Hebrew language, saying, Chapter 22. "Brethren and fathers, hear my defense before you now." And when they heard that he spoke to them in the Hebrew language, they kept all the more silent. Then he said, "I am indeed a Jew, born in Tarsus of Cilicia, but brought up in this city at the feet of Gamaliel, taught according to the strictness of our father's law, and was zealous toward God, as you all are today. I persecuted this way to the death, binding and delivering into prisons both men and women, as also the high priest bears me witness, and all the council of the elders, from whom I also received letters to the brethren, and went to Damascus to bring in chains even those who were there in Jerusalem to be punished. Now it happened, as I journeyed and came near Damascus about noon, suddenly a great light from heaven shone around me, and I fell to the ground and heard a voice saying to me, 'Saul, Saul, why are you persecuting me?' So I answered, 'Who are you, Lord?' And he said to me, 'I am Jesus of Nazareth, whom you are persecuting.' And those who were with me indeed saw the light and were afraid, but they did not hear the voice of him who spoke to me. So I said, 'What shall I do, Lord?' And the Lord said to me, 'Arise and go into Damascus, and there you will be told all things which are appointed for you to do.' And since I could not see for the glory of that light, being led by the hand of those who were with me, I came into Damascus. Then a certain Ananias, a devout man according to the law, having a good testimony with all the Jews who dwelt there, came to me. And he stood and said to me, Brother Saul, receive your sight. And at that same hour I looked at him. Then he said, The God of our fathers has chosen you that you should know his will, and see the just one, and hear the voice of his mouth. For you will be his witness to all men of what you have seen and heard. And now why are you waiting? Arise and be baptized, and wash away your sins, calling on the name of the Lord. Now it happened, when I returned to Jerusalem and was praying in the temple, that I was in a trance, and I saw him saying to me, Make haste and get out of Jerusalem quickly, for they will not receive your testimony concerning me. So I said, Lord, they know that in every synagogue I imprisoned and beat those who believe on you. And when the blood of your martyr, Stephen, was shed, I also was standing by consenting to his death and guarding the clothes of those whom were killing him. Then he said to me, Depart, for I will send you far from here to the Gentiles. And they listened to him until this word. And then they raised their voices and said, Away with such a fellow from the earth, for he is not fit to live. Then as they cried out and tore off their clothes and threw dust into the air, the commander ordered him to be brought into the barracks and said that he should be examined under scourging so that he might know why they shouted so against him. And as they bound him with thongs, Paul said to the centurion who stood by him, Is it lawful for you to scourge a man who is a Roman and uncondemned? When the centurion heard that, he went and told the commander, saying, Take care what you do, for this man is a Roman. Then the commander came and said to him, Tell me, are you a Roman? He said, Yes. The commander answered, With a large sum I obtained this citizenship. And Paul said, But I was born a citizen. Then immediately those who were about to examine him withdrew from him, and the commander was also afraid after he had found out that he was a Roman, and because he had bound him.
Well, thank you, Dave. Are there any questions or comments, reflections from the passage here today? Now, remember where we were the last time we were going through this. The reason why we're picking up here in verse 27 is we were starting the look at chapter 21 from the standpoint of this accusation that was brought against Paul. Now, you notice here in chapter 21, there's accusations coming from two sides. Not only the believers who were Jews inside the congregation, and then he also was getting accusations from the people who were coming in from the diaspora Jews, who most likely were not believers there in the temple, also making a similar accusation. So he was almost getting the same accusation from both sides of the fence. One side saying that he was teaching the Jews in the diaspora to disregard the Torah, the temple, and the traditions, and also the diaspora Jews who were in the temple itself saying pretty much the same thing, and also drawing the conclusion regarding the Greek that they had seen with him. Now, as we start into this section that we're looking at first, we pick this up. Now, as you recall, the last time we talked, this proclamation that came from the Apostle Yaakov, or James, was to go and sponsor and purify himself, Paul, with these four men who had most likely taken a Nazarite vow, and to sponsor them through a purification process and to the completion of their time as a Nazir. Now, this was to, as you might recall, to basically to show the believers who were Jews, that Paul was not indeed trying to dismantle the practices of Torah among believers. So that was the context of where he was going into. Now, it's always kind of good to take a look at this, because if you ever get a chance to take a look into the Mishnah at all, which are some of the writings of some of the early rabbis up to the first few centuries, there is a whole long section on Nazir. In fact, what the title of that is, Nazir. And you go through there, and there are a lot of pretty pointed and long-winded discussions of what it meant to declare yourself a Nazir, who could declare themselves a Nazir, how long that was, what would happen if you didn't fulfill it, what you had to do to fulfill it. But it's interesting that the one thing you do not find, in there, in the Mishnah, is what you see right here in Acts. This thing about this 7-day period. Now there is, when you look in Numbers chapter 6, we'll get into that in just a bit, there is the 7-day period, but that relates to a Nazir who did one of the big three no-nos as a Nazir, which is contacting with the dead, touching the dead or such like that, to also to drink wine or have anything to do with anything related to grapes and such like that. So these things were in there. However, it does not say that at the end of it, you go through this 7-day process. But you see clearly that it's talked about there that that Paul went in, and it says like at the beginning part of 26, which we didn't read in this part, we ended last time with, that he went and he made a proclamation. What it says there in Greek is he like made a declaration. Now, the interactions between the Nazirs and the temple was done through the priesthood. So Paul was making a declaration to the priesthood on his first part before the 7-day period. Now, the Mishnah doesn't talk about what this 7-day period, to end it in a good, well-followed scenario for the Nazirite vow is. Most likely, just speculation, is perhaps that it was like a check-in period. Are you ready? Have you been faithful to follow the Nazir vow all the way through? Because when you do look in the Mishnah, there was a whole lot of room in there for people to make all kinds of accusations that you did not go through with it, and you failed in one way or the other. I saw you do this, I saw you do that. Perhaps that might be a little bit what's behind that whole thing of seeing Paul later or earlier in the city with someone from Ephesus who was likely a Gentile, because there's items in there in the Mishnah talking about Nazirs and whether that would be for Gentiles and interactions of uncleanness. And our last time we talked about the issue, or we started the discussion on works of law, and one of the big ideas of the Maaseh HaTorah of the time period around this time we see in the Dead Sea Scrolls relates to interactions with people who are considered unclean of the nations. So you've got those two kind of things dovetailing here. First century views of the Nazirs and things around them, plus the idea of works of law and the idea that people of the nations, Gentiles, that interactions with them would put you into a fast track to uncleanness, which was the thought of the time. So you've got those two kinds of things working together there. Now, just a quick review of the Nazirite vow. It's found in number 6 from 1 to 22. One of the things you see there, right at the first part of that, is that it involves a man or a woman, kind of unique among this. It's quite an interesting thing when you read it in Hebrew, because it's very alliterative. And interestingly, in Greek, it's also alliterative. So when they did the Septuagint version, they captured the same alliteration that you have in the Hebrew, because there's the play of words that you get between nader, which is a vow, and nazer, which is the Nazirite. So you get that play of words back and forth in there. But one of the interesting things that you get in there is that this involves a Some translations, you might have it where it says a difficult vow. In your translation might say a difficult vow. But really, it's a wonderful vow, a spectacular vow. Because the same word that you get in there, yafli, is used throughout the Tanakh to refer to miracles, a miraculous happening. So this is something marvelous in there. The Greek version of this uses the adjective mega, which means massive, a massive sort of vow that you're taking. And what's something that's interesting when they went through with the Septuagint version of this is that in the Septuagint they use the form when they translate this, you know, they use a form of holiness, or you know, for the idea of consecration. In the same place that they use that same word is over in Numbers chapter 8, verse 21, referring to the consecration of priests. So it's really quite interesting, this idea of cleansing. And the Hebrew for that item over there in Numbers chapter 8 is tahar. So it's a different word from the nazir that you see in Numbers chapter 6, but has the idea of a cleansing that's going on. So this is a cleansing and a consecration, a setting apart. Now, something also among the various things that we know about abstaining from strong drink and wine, vinegar made from wine or liquor or grape juice seeds, anything to do with grapes during this period. And of course, there's the idea of the haircut, that you don't get one during this period. Now, it's interesting, the period, because in the Mishnah, it talks on along about, well, how long is it? Well, it says basically that you declare how long it is when you take it. And if you don't, then it's 30 days. And in some situations, that's like increments of 30 days beyond that if certain things happen and there runs into problems with it. But it's basically that it's a period of time that you either declare, or at least in the first century, in that context, was thought to be around 30-day period. Now, one of the interesting things that a lot of skeptics bring up about the God of the Bible is that, well, what are you saying? That the tabernacle and later the temple, this is where the presence of God is, and yet only certain people get to go in there, you know, priesthood, talking about descendants of only a certain family of the Levites, and then the high priest is only of one person out of all that gets to actually be in the presence of God. Now, that's, what about everybody else? But the interesting thing when you look at this is that the Nazir vow is on par with the high priest vow in quite a few different ways. One of which is the contact with the dead. A priest, a regular priest, could actually take care of a family member who died. High priest couldn't, Nazirs couldn't. Which was kind of interesting when you look in the Mishnah, they kind of had this idea, okay, well, if there was a case where someone died and you couldn't take care of the body, was it better that a Nazir took care of that body or a high priest took care of the body? And they said, well, it'd be better for a Nazir because the high priest was a lifelong job. That was a lifelong consecration. So just kind of an interesting thing that the Nazirs were on par with the high priest in their consecration. In fact, this a similar language when they talk about holy to the Lord, that's also used for the high priest and for the Nazirs as well. They're called that.
I just think it's kind of an interesting point. In our day, we don't think about this too much. But even in the 1800s, doctors were arguing over not whether or not to wash their hands. And doctors were actually outcast if they taught washing your hands before surgery.
Yeah, deliver babies, then go do an autopsy.
Yeah.
Or vice versa, actually.
Yeah. And so this idea of purification had some real medical that would have prevented the plagues of the in the Middle Ages, and we just sort of take it for granted now because it's so much part of our understanding. You wash your hands to make yourself clean.
Yeah. Yeah. So what you're talking about is a lot of what the priesthood did was public health department stuff, but also that physical stuff had a spiritual meaning to it. And part of what we're going through in Passover and the Feast of Unleavened Bread is the physical has something really bearing on the spiritual. And that was ends up you seeing get lost a lot during the prophet times. They're always railing about that.
There are times that the Nazirite vow is still being used today. There are times when you have a job or an office in a group that cannot be filled by the person who should be there to fulfill it. So it's still being taken as a vow during a certain period of time for someone to walk into service that normally isn't. If they accidentally have balsamic vinegar, which would break the vow, they begin again. So in a sense, better the Nazir handle the dead body because all they have to do is they start their 30 days over again. So, and it's still being used. It's a way to fill an obligation when you can't fill it and we have no one to fill it. What do you do if your group has no one to handle certain things?
Yeah, but it's certainly not a willy-nilly vow because of what we see, the huge cost of when you end it, that sort of consecration that you see in the offerings that are offered, that's pretty significant.
Well, that's pretty hard now because there's not a temple to offer it.
Yes.
But the hair is the offering.
Mm-hmm.
And the hair is what that person has produced during that vow. If you take your vow for 6 months or a year, your hair is going to be long and you have to deal with what you're going to do. But that hair is your produce. That's what you produced during that year. That's the only thing that you have, and you cut it and you give it to God. You burn it.
Yeah, it's certainly not something to be taken lightly, which when you see there, that has a lot of significance for the thing that we're looking at here in Acts, because, you know, Yaakov is very wise when he suggested that Paul does this, because he is basically having him interact with one of the most holiest vows there is. There is an office, even though a temporary one, on par with the high priest in its significance. So for Paul to make that physical statement is saying very pointedly that I take the Torah very seriously.
I don't know it to be a fact, but I would almost wonder, because with the military, when you go into boot camp, they shave your head. The purpose of that is to make everybody look the same, to take away your personal identity, because your hair really speaks of who and what you are, how you care for it, comb it, blah, blah, blah. It would seem that quite possibly the shaving of the head at that point in time would also be a form of losing your identity, in a sense, to Christ or unto God. You know, because that really kind of helps identify who you are.
Yeah.
Just a thought.
And it's good that God has them all numbered.
This is not about the Nazirite vow, but as I'm sitting here thinking of this, what the issues of these Gentiles, Paul, as long as Paul's speaking in Hebrew, everybody's listening. And then he mentions the Gentiles. The whole issue earlier on that causes him to take the Nazirite vow is because they think he has a Gentile. Way back in Acts 6, is it, when Stephen, before Stephen, it's around when they are talking about the deacons, because there's a complaint that the Jews are getting, the widows are getting a more favorable deal than the, it seems that there is a real, it's an ethnic issue, isn't it? This issue of Gentiles is actually far larger than I think most people have previously considered at the time.
Yeah, well, it's a huge issue under the whole idea of works of law, which is a huge issue undercurrent underneath of Romans and most of the letters going on down the pike. It's quite a significant thing. Now, it's really quite interesting that as we look into this second part of starting there in verse 31 of chapter 21, we see that here this Roman commander comes up and tries to get a handle on the situation, because you know we've seen as you go through the accounts in the life of Messiah, that, and you can read through history as well, that Roman commanders got incredibly nervous when the appointed times had come around because of the fear that Jerusalem would get out of control and that they would be held personally responsible. And there's historical records of that indeed happening. So this idea of a report that the whole city is in tumult is like, oh no. So you can understand why they sent the shock troops down there. But this is quite interesting. This, he brings up this account in verse 38. You know, then you are not the Egyptian who some time ago stirred up a revolt and led the 4,000 men of the assassins out into the wilderness. It seems like just this kind of passing phrase. It's kind of interesting. There's a passage from Josephus in Antiquities of the Jews, section 20, and they have different markers for it, but it's kind of the modern way of doing it is starting in verse, quote, 169. Moreover, there came out of Egypt about this time to Jerusalem one that said he was a prophet and advised the multitude of the common people to go along with them to the Mount of Olives, as it was called, which lay over against the city, and at the distance of 5 furlongs. He said further that he would show them from hence how at his command the walls of Jerusalem would fall down, and he promised that he would procure them an entrance into the city through those walls when they were fallen down. Now when Felix was informed of these things, he ordered his soldiers to take their weapons and came against them with a great number of horsemen and footmen from Jerusalem, and attacked the Egyptian and the people that were with them. And he also slew 400 of them and took 200 alive. But the Egyptian himself escaped out of the fight and did not appear anymore. I think not. So that is the account from Josephus in this regard. So it's really quite interesting when you see this talk. We saw that earlier about the idea of false messiahs coming along. Well, here's one of them. A record of them. So that was about, so because Felix was around the time period of the AD 50, so about AD 54 is kind of what they're thinking this time frame is. So you get kind of the thought of where we are in the time frame here. As the idea of the first Shavuot that we started Acts with was, you know, around AD 30 or somewhere around there. And now we're at AD 54. That's 24 years at least later. Really quite interesting that all this stuff that we've been talking about has come down. And especially when we were looking there in the earlier part of Acts chapter 21, that this discussion that Susan brought up about Jews and non-Jews, believers together, that's 24 years later. And they're still hashing out this Jerusalem Council thing. Which, as we get into Galatians, one of the thoughts there is that was written before the Jerusalem Council. Because the Jerusalem Council verdict that Yaakov mentions earlier in chapter 21 is not referenced, which would have ended pretty much the discussion right off the bat. So just something to keep in mind as we go forward on that. But one of the interesting things that you see in this is that the Roman commander saying, oh, well, you're not that rabble-rouser that came out of Egypt. And probably most likely it sounded like he came out of Alexandria because that was the big center for Jews down there in Egypt. So likely came out of Alexandria. Remember, as we talked about before, that time frame, they had their own temple down there. I mean, that was a big center of gravity. So to stage this thing, getting this messianic complex that he's just going to go up and pull a Yehoshua and knock the walls down, that was quite a bold thing. But it's also something to keep in mind here as we look at this, that to be very careful when people start making these sorts of claims, because it mentions he had a lot of people that went along with him, a lot of people. So always something good to keep in the back of your mind. One of the next sections that we look at, starting there with verse 40 is where Paul starts addressing the crowd. And Susan touched on this briefly, but it's kind of interesting that you get these two passages, like in there in verse 40, where he says, you know, when there was a great hush, he spoke to them in the Hebrew dialect. And then again in verse 2, you know, when they heard he was addressing them in the Hebrew dialect, they became even more quiet. Now, it's kind of an interesting note. We talked last time about the Dead Sea Scrolls and that the manuscript 4QMMT, which has the passage that we talked about with a parallel idea to the works of law, talks about Ma'aseh HaTorah. Well, one of the things that's also come about with some of these manuscripts that have come through in times past is that we see that around the first century there are very good Hebrew documents, like the Hebrew Ben Sira is one of those, which you can find in the Apocrypha, and also the Bar Kokhba letters, which when we talk about false messiahs, there's another one. But that's kind of the same time period that you have good Hebrew writing in there that reflects a living language. So, but we also have writings that are in Aramaic. So when you start thinking of this, you've got lots of languages going on here. You've got Hebrew, you got Aramaic. A lot of the common people stuff was written in Aramaic. The more scholarly stuff, like you see in the Dead Sea Scrolls, that was Hebrew. And of course, you had Greek operating here and probably Latin that the Romans had brought in, but mostly Greek because that was kind of the language of commerce throughout the empire. And we've seen that earlier. But one of the uses of that phrase there, Hebraeos in Greek, can be used for Aramaic or Greek. But Aramaic or Hebrew, hello. So when we look at that, who is he talking to? Who are the people that were making this big uproar that we saw there in the temple? Yeah, but where were they from? Where were they from? It says where they were from. It's very important to kind of take a look and see where they were coming from. One of the things that we see is that they were coming up out of Asia. He was wanting to be in Jerusalem for one of the appointed times. So he's talking to folks out of Asia. And you remember what we talked about before with the Pharisees, how they would go off and they established all these synagogues here and there throughout the Roman Empire. Well, we've also talked about how a huge problem that devout believers had to live basically a godly life in a pagan bubble around you. It was hugely a problem. And that's where the Septuagint came from, is because a lot of these people ended up, either the God-fearers or descendants of Jews themselves, couldn't read or speak Hebrew anymore, so they had to have it in Greek. So to hear someone from the diaspora himself, really, he was talking about coming from Tarsus, which was up in Syria, and these people coming down from modern-day Turkey, talk about authority. Here he is speaking, orating in Hebrew. That had a huge impact. As you can understand why they got quiet, because they think he's just some rabble-rouser from the diaspora coming down, spouting, you can throw the Torah off, as you can see in some of the writings from Trypho and others later on in this time period, that's almost what they started advocating after a while. So to have him start speaking in Hebrew would be quite significant. Got to get their attention. But how he starts off there, in verse 1 of chapter 22, brethren and fathers, hear my defense, which I now offer to you. Sound familiar? Yeah, we heard that before in Acts chapter 6, and that was from Stephen. Now, it's interesting, when you look back, starting in chapter 6 and verse 13, going on into chapter 7, that Stephen was accused of the same things that Paul was. What was he again? Teaching against the Torah, against the temple, and against the tradition. So Stephen faced the same thing and the same arguments when they hauled him out and they started the uproar there. and starts into his defense quite similarly. Now, Paul also offers this thing, you know, being born in Tarsus, brought up in the city, educated under Gamaliel. That's no schlock. It was when you read some of the Mishnah and then into the Talmud, he's quite the big figure there. Quite a very significant sage. So in addition to being able to speak and orate in Hebrew, he's also being able to say, look, I know the Torah. I was taught very well under the Torah. Gamaliel is a very respected Torah teacher. But as he goes on in his discussion down there in verse 12, he mentions again Ananias, this man who was devout by the standard of law and well spoken of by all the Jews who lived there. So he's getting on into his own story, retelling it again, as he had in a couple of other cases. So he's retelling his personal testimony again. And also saying that here, this witness of his change was also someone very respected as someone who walked according to the way God prescribed in the Torah. So again, emphasizing that, you know, I didn't take off on a tangent here. Someone who witnessed my change, someone very grounded in the Torah, saw me going off in this direction in a right course. Now, it's also very significant that this witness comes in, like you see in verse 15, that this Ananias said this would be to all men. Because later on, when you see that uproar beginning, it's in that context that this was a message that was to go to all people. Not just Jews, not just in Israel, but to all people. So that's a quite important aspect of this. And then also that this message would come from... Now, I don't know if you catch this. Remember who he's talking to here. He's talking to most likely non-believers who are already on his case for trying to teach something different from what the Torah was teaching. And he just kind of drops this little thing in there. It almost seems like in passing, you know, Ananias there in verse 14, the God of our fathers has appointed you to know his will and to see his righteous one. To see his righteous one and to hear an utterance from his mouth. Now, Stephen himself also mentions the righteous one, you know, the tzaddik. Well, you might remember from Isaiah 53 also talks about the righteous servant. The righteous one is a euphemism for Messiah. To see Messiah. To be in the presence. And to hear the words. Now, again, where is he talking about this? In the temple. Okay, in the temple where was supposed to be the presence of God, physical presence of God. The Holy of Holies. Who went there? When? Once a year. And here's Paul just saying, oh, I saw the righteous one. I heard him speaking to me personally. Yeah. Which yes.
And the Shekinah glory had not been seen for many years, though, right, in the temple?
Yeah, it was you could almost say that the lights were on with the menorah, but nobody was home.
Yeah.
Sorry, that was a bad one. I had to slip that in there. But certainly, Ichabod, the glory had departed. But that statement right there can't be, you know, overemphasized. That this was people who are well grounded in what the Torah said, including passages like Deuteronomy 18, talking about this great prophet that would come along, which was later kind of seen to be the Messiah. And that is a very, very significant thing to have in there, that this message that this was supposed to go to the nations was coming from Messiah, from Messiah's mouth, in presence of Paul. So as we move further into this, Paul has described his conversation with the righteous one, and that the execution of Stephen was on par with killing of the prophets. Because remember what Stephen said. He said, in the context of talking about the righteous one, that this was what the prophets had foretold. They had killed the messenger. And that righteous one was Yeshua. And that's what's coming down here. Now as you see this, that's what got them excited. You would think that the uproar would have started there. Because he's saying, oh, I talked to Messiah personally. And Messiah personally gave me a message. Okay. Well, then he goes on, and what got them excited was that what did Messiah tell him to do? Yes, that's the last part of the message that got them to the point of starting up the riot yet again. Was that Messiah was telling him to go out. It really is quite incredible that here we have yet another witness, another prophet coming along.
You know, I was just thinking some of the background to this. The people are very defensive. We know from the Mishnah, for example, that 40 years before the fall of the temple, the red cord had not turned white on the Day of Atonement. We know that one of the lights is that the eternal light in the temple refused to stay lit. Mm. And they also knew that the doors, which ordinarily they had swung open of themselves and had stopped doing that. And so, or at least maybe that's the other way around. But anyway, three amazing things had happened concerning the temple and the Day of Atonement and the eternal light in the temple. And so we know, and if this is, what did you say, 25 years?
Yeah, at least.
These things had already started to happen. It was already a bit shaky. It's in the back of their minds. This had to have been, you know, common knowledge, or at least within the group of people who are most familiar with the temple, the most religious. There's already a question there. And Paul is now saying, I mean, on one level, you can almost feel the anger rising before it bursts. It had to have colored some of their thinking, I think.
Yeah. Well, if anyone were paying attention, they would have seen that some of the hallmarks of the fall of the previous temples were starting to spill out again. Because once you start knocking off the prophets who were coming with the messages, then the end was near. And you think about that, this is 54, around 50, AD 54. The handwriting on the wall for Jerusalem started about 65, 66, when they really started making the approach to destroy it. That's 10 years. It's building up like crazy. This is a pressure cooker. And as we look at this, we see that, you know, when there in verse 23 it talks about the commanders, like, you know, what happened? You know, first they were going crazy. Then he grabbed Paul, put him in chains. Then Paul said, let me talk to him. Starts talking to them in Hebrew. They quiet down, and he's talking for a while. And suddenly they blow up again, and he's wondering what on earth happened. You know, here he took Paul out of the pressure cooker, away from the crowd, and now he managed to talk himself back into a riot again. That's You can imagine the impression that was upon the Roman in this case.
Yeah, going back to what you're talking about earlier here for a second. When he was with Ananias, that was in Damascus. But yeah. When he says here, with 17, 18, 19, that time, he's in Jerusalem praying in the temple, and yep. The Lord says to him, go, I want to send you to the Gentiles. So not only is Paul saying that Yeshua told me to go to the Gentiles, Yeshua told me when I was praying in this very temple
yep.
that I am supposed to go to the Gentiles.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that went over very well, didn't it?
Yeah. that the owner of the house who had extended the invitation back in Solomon's time was doing so again. Someone? Okay. But we notice here kind of we talked a little bit about Stephen and also with Paul and a lot of the similarities in this. And you can kind of really see that heartbreak. And you see it in some of the other letters we'll get to, this heartbreak over what he had done to Stephen over time. But one of the great things that we see there is that Stephen did not shrink from proclaiming the good news. He basically talked himself into his execution by just saying what God told him to say. Paul, same thing, talked himself into his own trial and actually really worked it out so he would get a trial. So he would be in front of all the people he would, as we're going to go on and see, he testified in front of all the powers there. That was a part of the plan. So it's really quite disheartening that you see so many people, when they look at a passage like this, think that Paul made a big mistake by capitulating, by pandering to the Jews, playing with their Torah, that he made a big mistake. He did himself in and took the world away, and it took himself away from the world as a great proclaimer of the word. But as you see in this, Stephen did not shrink from it. He ran. That's where God sent him. He went into it. And as we've seen here, God had been directing Paul in this direction. And this is the direction where Paul was going. One of the last things that we look at this, and this should not entirely surprise us, is Messiah said this many different ways, one of which we'll end with, starting in a passage we all know well, but continuing on, to describe the very situation that really happened here in the temple. John 3:16. Because God so loved the world, he gave his only begotten Son, that whoever believes in him shall not perish, but have everlasting life. Because God did not send the Son into the world to judge the world, but that the world might be saved through him. He who believes in him is not judged. He who does not believe has been judged already, because he has not believed in the name of the only begotten Son of God. This is the judgment, that light has come into the world, and men loved the darkness rather than the light, for their deeds were evil. Because everyone who does evil hates the light, and does not come into the light, for fear that his deeds will be exposed. But he who practices the truth comes into the light, so that his deeds may be manifested as having been wrought in God. Now, a lot of people talk about this idea of walking the way, walking in the way of God, as being, something you do yourself. These deeds are shown as being from God. Through you, through me, because why? And it talks about that in Matthew chapter 5. So people will see what you do, the good things, and praise whom? The Father in heaven. That's where the glory needs to get directed. It's not that you shirk away from what God says, but you do it, and that is to be a testimony to the world. Are there any final thoughts or comments as we close out today's? Yeah.
Kind of a minor one. Simple minds are, fascinated by these kinds of things. But, you know, the Roman Empire was such a noble empire at this time. We think of them during their fall, which is coming, which is imminent.
Yeah, that's 400 years later.
Yeah, but you look at the... They were fearful because they were people of law that they were about to flog a Roman citizen, and they took him at his word. The soldiers immediately went and told the centurion. The centurion questioned him, didn't call him a liar, didn't ask him to provide proof.
Because claiming to be a citizen and not being one got you the death penalty. So
they're very professional and very much a people under law. It's just, yes. It struck me as interesting. Well, like we used to be. You
know? Yes, I heard about that once. Any other thoughts? Okay, well, let's close in prayer. Father God, we thank you so much for giving us your word, and we thank you for the testimony of your witnesses like Stephen and Paul and Moses and all of the prophets. And we thank you for giving us the righteous one and for making us righteous through him. We thank you in the name of Yeshua. Amen.